Hello, my name is Elaine Charvet. I'm a doctoral researcher at the Oxford University Museum of Natural History. On my first day at the museum, I was given an enormous bunch of keys and told I could open every cupboard and door. That was one of the best days in my life. In these podcasts, I want to share with you some of the treasures I've encountered on my many forays into attics and cellars, cupboards and storerooms. I've also been very privileged to meet many experts who do research, look after the collections and the visitors, and turn the museum into a living organism we can all be part of. But looking at the crowds visiting the museum every day, here's the chance to create a microcosmos of nature and science, to celebrate geo and biodiversity. But also to talk about hugely important topics such as the loss of biodiversity, the climate emergency, and man-made extinctions. This series of podcasts takes a close look at some fascinating and surprising objects in the Oxford University Museum of Natural History. It's a kind of fringe event to go hand in hand with a major redisplay happening at the museum in 2022. Each podcast is a journey of discovery through the nooks and crannies of the museum, talking to researchers and experts on the way. We'll seek out the rarely seen or heard about enigmatic objects in the museum and their stories, scientific, historical, and personal. These objects can be specimens, natural objects, artifacts, tools, or even museum internals such as conservation fluids. What they all have in common is that they speak to us about ecology and biodiversity. Both terms are linked. Without constantly evolving ecological relationships, there is no biodiversity. Is there even such a thing as biodiverse objects? Well, let's find out. Welcome to our first Biodiverse Objects podcast. On display, nature's dramas, nature's dioramas. This one is all about biodiversity captured and displayed, sometimes in weird and wonderful ways. Diorama. The name comes from the Greek, literally meaning that through which is seen. I like to remind myself of that, because the diorama indeed acts like a lens, focusing our attention. But it is also a stage. Natural history dioramas are definitely putting the drama into nature. It's an old-fashioned term, and we tend to think of dioramas as a 19th century thing. But even in the 19th century, there were many different incarnations of the diorama. Today, most of the museum's dioramas are in storage. They are often no longer seen as a good way to communicate knowledge about the natural world. It probably does not help that many of them are in quite bad nick or represent outdated concepts, and to our eyes, they can look terribly kitschy. I would say that there are two types of dioramas. One is the realistic diorama, the lens that tries to cram into a display box everything that we know at this point in time about a particular group of animals and their environment. Well, let's have a look at some in the bird store. So here we have the animals themselves as taxidermy. Landscapes in the background are often very beautifully painted. In the foreground, there are geological features, rocks or caves, dens, vegetation, often modelled in 3D from papier-mâché or plaster, plastic or fiberglass. The taxidermy animals can be arranged in very dramatic poses. Think, for instance, of a golden eagle crushing with enormous talons on its yellow feet the fluffy head of a snow hare it has just caught. Next to it are grey rocks with patches of snow in their shadows. There are splotches of red on the white. And if you look carefully, you can see another snow hare pressed completely flat onto one white patch behind a rock, hiding, its white fur already starting to reveal patches of brown with the coming spring. To one side, in a respectful distance, is a raven. Its black feathers are shining. As a scavenger, it eats either carrion or benefits from predators making a kill, like this one. Although an impressive bird, it looks small compared to the eagle, a convenient indicator of scale. In the background, there are painted snow-capped mountains and the moody skies of the Scottish Highlands. So captured in this diorama, we have predator-prey relationships, scavenger behavior and interdependencies, adaptation of the snow hare, which turns white in winter, camouflage behavior, also of the snow hare, as well as the eagle's killing techniques and anatomical details. So for instance, on its feet, the backwards pointing digit and talon are particularly important for making the kill. So this digit acts like a thumb and it has a razor sharp long equivalent of a nail. And together with the opposing digit and talon, it can grab like a hand. And if we look closely, we can see that these two digits and claws are the largest on the eagle's foot. And a golden eagle's claw can be well over 6 centimeters long. But there's also the habitat, the Scottish Highlands, with the particular geology and perhaps even some of the lichen, mosses, plants specializing in this harsh, nutrient-poor environment. So all of this seems like a lot when you think about it, but is, of course, only the tip of the ecological iceberg. Despite being a lens as well as a stage, this diorama only captures the scales and phenomena that are easily visible to us. What about the micro level? Clouds of midges, parasites on the hare, like, for instance, ticks, parasites on the eagle, like mites, microorganisms in the ground digesting the last scraps of the dead hare, or big phenomena like the weather, landslides, or erosion. So all these complex networks may be as or even more important than what we can readily perceive. So these are the realistic dioramas and the ones you would usually find in natural history museums. But there are others. These are the ones we could perhaps call creative dioramas. That does not necessarily mean that they are not representing current scientific knowledge accurately, although some, also often dating from the 19th century, have definitely taken the drama aspect of the diorama to extremes and are more about showing off stunning colours or patterns of animals and artificial groupings. It's all about the wow factor and stunning interior design. In a best case scenario, these dioramas are a bit like remnants of the cabinets of curiosities of the Enlightenment, and 19th century creative dioramas were usually made for grand houses and were showing off exotic destinations and wealth. There are several examples in storage, as these dioramas are often part of larger private natural history collections that are donated to the museum. They often, very often seem to involve hummingbirds or other birds with beautifully coloured feathers. Taxidermy animals are usually central to dioramas, and birds are particularly popular in the decorative variety. The beautiful feathers evoke jewels, expensive fabrics, and either hunting exploits at home, using for instance birds like pheasants, or conjuring a tropical paradise, with hunting included, of course. So seeing the taxidermy animals inside or outside of dioramas are everywhere in natural history museums, even today, I thought I'd chat to an old friend of mine who actually studied how to prepare animals for museums. I'm curious how much of the living animal can be found in these stuffed animals, and about the knowledge and techniques used to turn them from carcasses into display objects, with her own stories and histories. This is Dr. Katrin Böhme, who is now a history of science expert at the Berlin State Library.
In the former GDR, the German Democratic Republic, when I learned the profession of the taxidermist from 1985 to 87, it was a really rare profession, only taught at some museums. I was strongly interested in animals, especially ornithology, and museums like the Naturkundemuseum in Berlin, which I knew quite well because my father was working there as a scientist. The profession fascinated me, its multiplicity of techniques, the art aspects, and the work in a museum with such a large and old collection of specimens.
I asked Katrin if she could describe for us how do you turn a living bird into a museum display specimen?
Okay, I will try. For instance, a jay. At first, there's always the question, is a specimen for exhibition or for scientific collection? If it has to be prepared for scientific collection, I have to make a so-called bird skin, which has to be solid and light. It looks like a sleeping bird lying on its back and its neck extended. If a specimen is needed for an exhibition, the taxidermist will try and give the bird the best possible look as near to life as possible. And of course, for this purpose, you have to know your species. How does the animal look like in life? What are the exact positions of the head, the tail, the wings? What color do the eyes have and how are they positioned in the head? And to go into the more technical side of taxidermy, preparing the bird means skinning it. You should end up with a torso, but wings, legs and head removed. This intact torso is then discarded with all organs neatly contained inside. So there's no mess if you have properly and very little blood. Only the wings, the legs and the skull remain covered by the skin, without any support of muscles, of course. Here you have to be very careful, because such preparations can easily get infested by insects, who in the end can destroy the specimen. You use special chemicals to avoid this. I used an arsenic solution, which was applied with a brush. Okay, back to the skin. The limbs are stabilized with wire. The throat remade with a wire from the skull to the artificial made torso. This torso has to have the same size and proportions as a natural body. In the next step, all the wires are fixed in the artificial torso. After all these technical steps, the most important procedure follows. Giving the bird its unique look by positioning it in a typical posture and form of behavior.
I have used the term stuffed animal before, but this doesn't sound at all like stuffing animals. So I asked Katrin if she thinks that the popular term stuffed animal is actually really misleading.
Yes, of course. This term recalls an old-fashioned, often unprofessional technique of literally stuffing animals, which often completely distorts their natural proportions. You can still find this today if the preparator has not been properly trained or in the historical techniques of former centuries. But if you want to create a specimen which captures the exact look, anatomy, habits and the character of an animal, you have to approach it with a lot of knowledge about the species and artistic skills.
Whoops, I will definitely make sure to use the term stuffed animal only for my teddy bears. But one final question for Katrin. I asked her how scientific knowledge, to what extent did knowledge about a particular animal, its behavior, observations, or even its environment play a role in preparing the taxidermy?
Without knowing anything about the animal, you can't do it. Taxidermy is a little bit like recreating the animal. For this, you have to know as much as possible about the species. How it moves, how it feeds, how it behaves, its character, the habitat and food. Take the jay. This lovely golden brown bird with a blue speculum on its wing feathers. He is the so-called watchman of the woods, because he is watching everything and gives a noisy screech of warning to the whole forest in case of danger. And he likes to eat acorn, which he often hides or steals from other birds or even squirrels. That's why a taxidermy jay is often shown sitting on a branch, looking down, attentively watching, its crest erect, nosy and noisy.
Thank you, Katrin. That is great. But dioramas without taxidermy, of course, do exist, often where the animals depicted are either long extinct, like dinosaurs, or too small, like microorganisms, or even too big, like whales. Here, models and reconstructions come into their own. For instance, there are dioramas that take us to the microscopic level, showing the hidden world of tiny but vital soil organisms. These can be as low-tech as back in the 19th century, using mainly papier-mâché and paints, or state-of-the-art, like computer-generated virtual reality environments. There is a great example developed at the Senckenberg Museum of Natural History in Görlitz, Germany. Virtually shrunk to the size of a woodlouse, you are able to meet soil dwellers at their scale and pace, from well-known characters such as earthworms, now giants, to antsy springtails and mites. These animals are in fact 3D virtual models with the aim to being scientifically accurate regarding scales, movement and behaviours. But they also convey a sense of wonder and awe. The same framework can be applied to long extinct worlds. Some of you may remember the first animals exhibition here at the Oxford Museum, with its animated and colourful reconstructions of the first complex life forms on Earth, reconstructed from fossils. But one of my favourite examples dates from the 18th century, and it captures animals about whose life cycles there was almost as little known as of dinosaurs in the first half of the 19th century. It is in fact what I would call a series of 2D dioramas. It is held in the museum's library. I guess that's a giveaway. Let's have a look. Right, let's go down the corridor. Some steps. Excellent. So this has been nicely laid out for us. A beautiful book. And this is Maria Sibylla Merian's work, important work. And she was an incredibly accomplished naturalist and illustrator and a pioneering entomologist. So I'll sit down. Have a good look at this, because this is a real treat to look at. Marian was born in Germany in 1647, and when she was 38, she left her husband, and in 1699 she travelled to Suriname and Guyana and stayed for 2 years. So scientific expeditions at this period of time were not common at all, especially not to this part of the world. And Marian's unofficial self-funded expedition raised many eyebrows. A single woman traveling to the end of the world, basically. She succeeded in discovering a whole range of previously unknown animals and plants, and in 1705 she published her famous work, The Metamorphosis of the Insects of Suriname, and this is what I'm looking at here. So let's open it. It's quite a heavy tome. So this particular copy I'm looking at here in the library is very special indeed. So this is the 1719 Dutch edition, but it has been customized and individually hand-painted on the orders of its Dutch owner, the collector Johan Rij de Breukelawert. Gosh, that's the name. He had bought the loose uncolored plates and the text sheets to have his special copy made, and had lots of gold thrown in, so it's quite a lavish copy. But the frontispiece is great fun. So this is a rather allegorical illustration, including a figure that is arguably Marian herself, surrounded by half-naked cherub-like children, bringing her specimens of plants and insects. But in this particular hand-painted version here, the lady herself, as well as the children, look muddy, with dirt on their legs, arms, and even faces. So is this smudged paint, or is it a tongue-in-cheek realistic touch concerning the reality of collecting in the field, in an otherwise very stylized scene? Who knows? But Most special of all is really what is contained in the plates. So Marianne studied insects in great detail, keeping her own live specimens, and made drawings showing insect metamorphosis in which all life stages of the insects were depicted. So egg, larva, pupa, and the adult. So in a way you could say her work, sometimes even one single illustration, ranged from the decorative or artistic to the realistic and scientific, fueled by her own observations, studies, experiments, and deductions. So insects, you can see here everywhere, insects and other animals are depicted laying their eggs, feeding or preying on each other. In a letter, Marianne did write, "I was not looking for any more creatures, but only at the formation, propagation, and metamorphosis of creatures, how one emerges from the other, the nature of the diet." So this is definitely not just a collector at work, nor just an artist. This is definitely a scientist at work. And Marianne not only noted the typical food plants of caterpillars, but also, for example, if a caterpillar fed exclusively on one particular plant, so that it was a specialist, versus the less exclusive ones feeding on a variety of plants, the generalists. So just like it was with the eagle and the hare diorama that we saw earlier, Marianne records the behavior of prey animals. In this case, it's the caterpillars instead of the hare. And when they are attacked, so some curl up and play dead, others twist and turn to pull themselves free. So in her earlier book on caterpillars, Marianne would record the cannibalistic behavior of certain caterpillars as well, and how they were used as hosts and food by parasitic wasps. So these are all food webs in action. This here is my favorite of all the absolutely exquisite illustrations in this book. So this is plate 18 of the Metamorphosis. And of course, everyone who sees this big and bold illustration for the first time will immediately be drawn to the large tarantula crouching over a dead hummingbird next to its nest and its tiny eggs. So the hummingbird appears to be much smaller than the tarantula, so it's a very striking image. The tarantula is burrowing into the neck of the colorful little bird, a ruby topaz hummingbird, which is lying on its back. It's quite gruesome. And one of the tarantula's legs is in an ever so sinister and casual way still sitting on the bird's nest, implying that the eggs are prey as well. So this formidable animal is the wonderfully named pink-toed tarantula. And they are indeed active tree climbers as depicted here. And yes, they have pink toes. The tips of their legs look a bit like they've been dipped in pink nail varnish. But there's so much more drama captured in the illustration. So ants here in the corner attacking a smaller huntsman spider and its spiderlings, and also trying to grab a roach. They are in turn preyed upon by a second tarantula that seems to prefer smaller prey than a bird. Leaf cutter ants are busy stripping the guava tree of its leaves, so there's a lot going on. Carl Linnaeus gave the tarantula its scientific Latin name, Araneia avicularia, based on this illustration here. Today, this particular tarantula is called Avicularia avicularia, and avicula means small bird. So does this refer to the prey suggested by Marianne, or perhaps to the tarantula's size being that of a small bird? Linnaeus in 1767, in his description of the pink-toed tarantula, writes that it ambushes small birds and insects. In fact, these spiders very rarely hunt and catch birds, so Marianne most likely observed a tarantula eating a dead bird. Even to the dedicated and scientific observer, drama can sometimes be irresistible. And in the tarantula's case, the drama became part of the animal's scientific name. So, intriguingly, avicularius in Latin, in fact, means bird keeper, perhaps an even more sinister name, implying that the spider harvests the birds and their eggs, like ants farm aphids for their sugary excretions. In a 1773 German translation and commentary for Linnaeus' original description, the tarantula is called hummingbird eater, adding that it eats mainly ants, but also attacks hummingbirds and sucks their eggs. It also records that their fangs are sometimes dipped in gold and used as toothpicks. Wow. I mean, poking between your teeth with tarantula fangs. To be honest, I find people much stranger and scarier than most animal behavior I've ever seen or read about. In an 1806 English edition of the work including Linnaeus' original description of the tarantula, it is also helpfully added that the tarantula's fangs are the size of hawk's talons and that its eyes can be set in the manner of glasses and used as microscopes. So this is not just an illustration capturing a snapshot of nature, biodiversity and ecology at a particular place, at a particular point in time, but it also captures cultural and historical elements. Marion's illustration set the wheels of science in motion, leading to the scientifically accurate description, naming and classification of this particular tarantula, but also the wheels of human imagination and, sadly, exploitation. I think the tarantula gets its fangs into anyone who looks at this illustration as surely as into the little hummingbird. See where it will take you. Fear or fancy? Curiosity to find out more? Arguing with the illustration? Contradicting observations and data? Or contributing your own? Or just wonder and admiration for Marion's sheer artistic talent and determination to travel, to observe, to experiment, and to increase our knowledge. But it's, of course, not just pictures or representations, dioramas that can make ecology and biodiversity very clearly visible to us. There are, of course, actual specimens that can do that. And when you look closely, there are many of these objects in the museum. So let's go and find one. Fossils can reveal so much about a long-lost environment. The only problem is that specimens are most of the time removed from their context to be exhibited in museums. However, some carry their contexts with them. So, here in the main court of the museum, I'll try and be a bit more quiet, or rather I should speak a bit more loudly because you will not be able to hear me, but so here a display features two shin bones, one fossilized, one modern, both of which have been chewed. Chewed, it turned out, by hyenas, one of them in Yorkshire, around 120,000 years ago. Hang on a minute. Hyenas in Yorkshire? So William Buckland, professor of geology at Oxford, was able to overturn one of the most widely held beliefs of the time when, in 1821, he visited Kirkdale Cave in Yorkshire. Bones of exotic animals like rhinos and hyenas had been found in Europe before, but the accepted explanation was that the bones were carried there by the biblical flood. Buckland, however, decided to take a more holistic view on the bones found in the cave, and by some very close examination of all objects in the cave and some very clever hands-on experiments which actually involved living hyenas, he discovered not only hyena tooth marks on some of the other bones,
but also fossilized hyena poo. How exciting is that? And this was proof that once upon a time, a hyena had lived in what is now Yorkshire, eating and digesting large animals which have long disappeared from the British Isles and indeed Europe. So a wonderful contemporary lithograph shows a young Buckland crouching to enter the famous cave, carrying a candle, clearly greatly upsetting three or four hyenas present, whereas one remains dreamily absorbed in gnawing a large bone. This is just a brilliant 2D diorama capturing an ancient fauna, its food webs, but also the modern naturalist capturing the hyenas in the act, as it were. So discovering fossils and interpreting their context is a very real form of time travel, and I just love that. Now for some objects behind the scenes, and also, I must admit, in my own collections. I am totally obsessed with amber. To me, pieces of amber are the ultimate diorama specimens, capturing ecological relationships. I know some people look at cat pictures and videos on the internet to relax and to get a rush of endorphins. I look at macro lens pictures of the inner worlds hidden in pieces of Baltic amber. So Baltic amber is usually around 44 million years old. It is the fossilized resin of probably a now extinct tree, possibly a relative of the Japanese umbrella pine. In the golden orange or reddish light of the amber, I, for instance, look at two ants locked in a tight embrace. They are two different species, so possibly a fight? Another ant has been trapped next to the aphids it may have farmed. Insect larvae are still attached to bits of their food plants. A chaotic bundle of crane flies in a tumble of their long legs point to maybe a mass emergence. A small beetle is trapped in a spider's web. The web is eerily luminous. In another piece, there is a spider actually caught in the act of building its web, and you can see its leg holding the spider silk issuing from its abdomen. Speaking of spiders, my favorite species of spiders are jumping spiders. So jumping spiders are so tiny and feisty. They are full of surprises, like the elaborate courtship dances some species engage in, but they are not just cute, they are fearsome predators. Well, tiny, but fearsome, often tackling prey much larger than they are. And this is exactly what I'm looking at now, a scene from 44 million years ago. A jumping spider measuring less than half a centimeter going after a big juicy fly. Or rather two. There's another fly. That one is slightly more intact than the mangled one next to the spider. It may be mangled, that fly, but its compound eyes are still staring with a look that one cannot resist calling startled. Amber can preserve colours in an astonishing way. And here it is, the eyes of the jumping spider looking at you. And they are red. It's incredible. I'm not sure which species it is, but it's probably now extinct. Jumping spiders have unique eyes. Their main pair of eyes is set forward facing, in many species in a flat, often hairy face, a bit like a monkey face. And the three remaining pairs of eyes are often wrapped round the head, so to speak, to give the spider a near 360 degree field vision. So it's an incredibly visual animal, just like us. And anyone meeting a jumping spider, if you notice it because it's so small, you will notice that it actually looks at you and appears to really follow you with its gaze. Someone has called them eight-legged cats because of their habit of just observing, stalking, and then pouncing on prey. So this habit in this case sadly made the jumping spider a prime candidate for getting trapped in the resin, which became the amber. So they probably saw the fly, which had got trapped in the resin, and they pounced on it and they got trapped themselves. If only I could spend my days looking at nothing but organisms caught in amber, I imagine I would be the happiest person alive. Actually, there is such a person at the museum. He has endured my curiosity and excitement and envy with incredible patience, and he has agreed to show us a few treasures. This is his office, and there is, of course, also a lab. His name is Dr. Ricardo Perez de la Fuente, and he researches life in amber. And I'm particularly fascinated by his research on evolving defensive behavior such as camouflage. So that is a very ecological topic and reminds me again of the eagle hair diorama and the Marian caterpillars. And there's more. Relationships between plants and pollinators, and one of my favorite topics, parasites. Even parasites on dinosaur feathers can be caught in amber. There is Baltic amber, which you can sometimes find yourself on the east coast of Britain, and that is around 44 million years old. There is also the much older so-called Cretaceous amber, which can be around 100 million years old, and that one can contain dinosaur remains. This, very sadly, is not the kind of amber you'd find on the beach, but you can find it here in Ricardo's office. Hello, Ricardo. Sorry, I'm trying to calm down. Thank you so much for sharing these treasures with us. So, where is your research taking you at the moment? And how are you actually looking at these minute, often quite hidden worlds in amber?
Thank you, Elaine, for inviting me to this podcast. It's a pleasure to be here. So right now, research is a bit slow because I'm mostly working on the redisplay project here at Oxford University Museum for Natural History. But I'm currently studying some lacewings, which is a type of insect, and some spiders preserved in 100 million year old amber, so fossilized plant resin. And that amber is mostly from Spain, from my homeland. So it's been an interesting last month.
So this is all the tech you're using, I guess, high-powered microscope?
Yes, indeed. So different types of microscopes. So one of them are stereomicroscopes that allows us to go high magnifications while still maintaining a 3D perspective of the samples, which of course is very important when going deep into an amber piece, right? We also use compound microscopes. In those, we lose the 3D vision, but some details get resolved better. Now, aside from microscopes, we also use an ingenious device, a very old one actually, called Camera Lucida.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
With the Camera Lucida, we entomologists are the few ones that are still using it. So it allows us to trace the shapes that we see under the microscope. So with one ocular, we see the sample, and with the other one, we see a sheet of paper that we put nearby. And so we can actually see, we can trace the fossil. Whenever you see a drawing from an entomologist, certainly by me, we are not artists most part of the time, we just trace. The entomologists, and particularly paleoentomologists, are among the few scientists that are still using that device.
Really good, because it trains your eye as well, doesn't it, in a way, but while you're tracing, you see it properly.
Exactly. And it's a very good excuse to get to actually see structures and get to understand your fossil, right? Because obviously you cannot draw when what you cannot understand. And also, it's definitely very useful to use the serum microscope and go up and down in the depth of field and see the different layers exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And only then is when you can start, you know, kind of incorporating all those layers into your drawing.
Oh, I like that. It's very new, very cutting edge technology and 19th century.
In a way, yes, we merged both.
Wow.
And aside from these classic techniques, nowadays we have also access to a series of new techniques that allows us to create virtual 3D models of our specimens.
Mm.
And then we can get to examine them from different angles, even those normally hidden, and even make virtual cuts of our specimens to see what's inside.
Oh, you can section them, basically.
Yes, yeah.
That's good that you can do that without actually destroying.
Absolutely, that's a huge advantage of these CT scans or tomographic techniques.
Well, this is certainly better than my pocket microscope. You can see a lot, but there's so much more to see. So what are your favorite examples of ecology and biodiversity that you've observed in amber? And is there a difference to what you would see in fossils preserved in rock?
Yes, and actually that's one of the main characteristics and, you know, special things about amber, right? That the resin was able to capture life almost instantly, right? That makes amber very different from other fossiliferous materials like rocks. Because in rocks, most part of the time, the organisms that became fossils, they had been hanging out, so to speak, in the environment for a while. Amber, though, you get a very small window of the past trapped inside. So it's definitely something that makes amber unique. Right now, in the case of my experience with this sort of scenes, so to speak, I have many that I like, but some of the closest to my heart are those entailing baby lacewings, lacewing larvae. Yeah. So one of them, and that was actually something that I had the chance to study already during my PhD, was a lacewing larva that was found preserved with a packet of or a cloud of trichomes surrounding the specimen. Now, it turns out that this specimen or this lacewing gathered that a cloud of trichomes from its environment.
Trichomes meaning fibers, hairs, I guess, usually from plants or lichen. They can have quite beautiful shapes. So in amber, you sometimes see star-shaped clumps, if that's the right word, because they're quite fragile looking, but you see them floating about like underwater creatures. They're quite stunning. But of course, this kind of debris can be very useful, and the larvae end up collecting this fluff floating about.
That's something that is found nowadays in modern relatives, in extant green lacewings, chrysopids. So they actively select different types of materials from their environment, and then they hoard them on their backs, where they get retained by special structures that and also special seti or hair-like structures that they are even hooked or serrated, and therefore they can attach those elements. Now, interestingly, it has a twofold purpose. It provides camouflage to approach their prey in an unsuspected way, right? Now, these larvae are predators themselves, but also it provides a physical protection, a shield that can be used against their predators. So it's a very smart, solution that through natural selection and millions of years of evolution, these insects got to acquire. It's one of my favorite examples because, aside from this ecological importance, we also were able to tell that these larvae were very different from their mother relatives.
Would the larvae show any predilections in what they pick up and use? I mean, it depends, of course, I guess, what kind of material is available in their environment. Is this something you'd be able to observe in the lacewing larvae that are caught in amber that you're investigating?
Absolutely. And it turns out that debris packet that the larva had hoarded on its back, it's entirely composed by these trichomes. And these trichomes have a very special morphology. They make a zigzag pattern. And that's why we think that they belong to a particular group of ferns that are actually associated nowadays with wildfires. So some species, some fern species, are prone to live in environments that get burned frequently, right? Actually, ferns are one of the first plants that get to colonize those areas. Apparently, it was a quite specific... Well, this is tentative, right? Because we only have one specimen. Most probably the time that's the case, right, with our findings, because chances that we find the same species are very, very unlikely, yeah. Right? We can posit that maybe the relationship was quite specific, right? Because those trichomes actually make a very fluffy structure, right? Oh, okay. So it could be very good in order to create your camouflage and protection. But at the same time, we found a similar larvae in other ambers, that such as those from Lebanon, which are even older than the Spanish amber, that they are carrying bits of soil on their back. And obviously soil is normally speaking, a more available material, right? They use specific species, or the trichomes, the plant trichomes of a specific species, right, of tree, or they can be more generalistic, in which they make use even of, you know, different sorts of materials, one individual.
And I love that, that they're using plants, so an insect is gathering, you know, plant material, is using stones and minerals and soil.
Yeah.
So you have that real interplay between the animate, the inanimate. Thank you very much. That is brilliant.
Thank you.
As I said, you've got the best job in the world. So
it's definitely something that still makes my days.
Well, yes, you're surrounded by amber, but have you ever found bits of amber yourself? I was really lucky to find a small piece, quite reddish one, on the Kent coast earlier this year. That was brilliant.
Amber floats in water, and of course, aside from that being a characteristic that we use to extract it in the field, it also means that the sea washes it, right? Mm. Sometimes on the shore. So I can see how finding some amber fragments when doing a walk on the beach must be a good experience. I've never found one myself though. So I still need to experience that.
Thank you so much, Ricardo, for this glimpse into lost worlds, but worlds that work in much the same way as today's with regard to ecological relationships and adaptations. So these worlds aren't really lost, they are still here. The players may have changed, but the rules of the game are still the same. We have covered quite a lot of ground, from 3D dioramas from the 19th century that contain taxidermy, to today's virtual reality reconstructions of ancient or hidden worlds. We've marveled at 2D depictions of insect and plant ecosystems from the early 18th century, and joined an early 19th century act of time travel through fossils, forensic fossils that bear the marks of their ecosystems, which are there for us to decode. We've also explored miniature dramas captured in many million year old amber. So, what are the kind of dioramas natural history museums should put on display today? How can we make biodiversity visible? Through virtual reality? Through better displays? By looking at the details and telling the incredible stories behind specific biodiverse objects? How do we keep the contexts, the ecology of objects and specimens alive in the museum and in the visitors' thoughts and imagination? Well, let us know your thoughts. And thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the journey and that you will join us for the next podcast in the series.